Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is now 9:00 on October 17th, 2023. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUB Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Walsh, President of Commission. We have here today Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, John Harlow, CEO, General Manager, Colin Willenbrock, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commission and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stoltz, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Commissioner Sidney Lopen, Vice President, is absent today. For written record, we'll indicate others who are present. Please turn off, please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO, General Manager, to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUB staff. I'll now turn the meeting over to our CEO, General Manager, for the briefing and study session. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Commissioner Walsh. Good morning, Commissioner Olson. Got lots of good stuff, so we'll get right at it. First up, our community engagement update and our amazing Laura Zorick. Morning, Laura.
Good morning. Thank you. Yeah, we had another set of wonderful events that we've had this past, let's see, I think the last time I gave an update was August. So since then, we've had the fair, we've had a whole number of different things, but we'll talk about a few of them this morning. So this is just kind of an overall summary of different events. This is another one that we had had. We were lucky enough to go out to Funco Field and have Family Day with the rest of our staff and their families. So Zip got to meet, Webley is the frog, and then I think it's just a hot dog. I'm not sure what that was.
Looks like mustard on it.
So much fun though. Yeah, I mean, whatever toppings you need, they probably got them there. But 2023, we participated in 8 parades across the district, approximately 29 separate events. And those are just kind of the ones that I help negotiate. There are always a plethora of additional events that take place that just are, you know, this is just a small snippet of them. 300 plus staff supporting these events, and they covered things. Most recently, we did have the Return of the Salmon Day, so fish biology, which is huge for our group since we do so much around the Salton River and habitat around there. Really focused a lot on Connect Up this year because we do have a lot to talk about. And then general awareness and safety are always kind of tied into everything that we do. Most recently, and several of the folks within this room participated in the Snohomish Run for Warmth. So they, it just was such a fun event. It happened just Sunday. So these are pictures from last year. I'll just say these pictures from this year are going to be significantly better. The weather was perfect. Sunday was just the right warmth, cold, and not smoky. So huge, huge pluses all in that. We did have Tanya Hansen, Kim Fenny, Janet Easterling, Yane Avatar, Lynn Dickin, Katie Jean was our zip, Allison Gawecki, John Harlow, Shelby Johnson, Chris George, David Kruger, and Krista Rasmussen that helped set up the booth, helped support the booth. We had our booth where you could also donate to Project Pride. But then we also were pretty much the cheering squad. We had a VIP tent. I think Lynn ended up using the cowbell so much that she got some blisters on her fingers. So we were out there cheering. It was such a fantastic event. And we actually raised double what we did last year. So at this point, we're just over $3,000 that they're going to be donating to Project Pride. So huge win. I heard a lot of great things about the motivational mile markers. They were very much meant to be tongue-in-cheek fun, but encouragement at the same time. And then, you know, this is not the end. We always have additional things. I know our ARC trailer goes to the Lake Stephen Harvest Festival every year. So we're going to be there as well. Two other things that just came up this week that I completely forgot to include. So we're going to have an event at one of our manufacturers tomorrow. And then on Friday is the solar summit, so our solar team is going to be over there supporting that.
Which manufacturer?
Synrad. So they make lasers, fascinating. Yeah, pretty neat. So this is kind of just their employee event where we bring information about our programs and stuff like that.
What did you say about a silver team?
A solar summit.
Oh, solar summit.
Yeah, so they go every year and we're going to give them some solar cars and then just some information that they can share with the community as well. It's just a big, either manufacturers or new innovative things all surrounding solar.
That's at South Seattle College?
I'm not sure, I think it is, yes.
Yeah.
I know the other one that we used to participate in was the one in Shoreline that was a big solar summit. That was during the summertime. But then these other two will be coming up right around the corner. So we will be at Port of Everett's Holiday on the Bay, which we will hopefully have a holiday meet and greet with Zip. It'll be nice at least to wear that costume in the cold weather versus, not that it was super hot on Sunday, but it was definitely warm. and then December 8th, right here in our building, we're going to have the Holiday Bazaar, and we're working right now to hopefully have a recycling event with that. So with Ridwell, we're not going to have the holiday lighting exchange, but we can help our community recycle what, you know, is difficult for them to recycle otherwise. And then that's it. Any questions? Yes.
Good job.
Thank you.
Did you go to the baseball game?
No.
I thought you were going to roll around for the board.
I love to watch baseball, but I couldn't.
I wasn't.
It was a lot of fun, but it, yeah, and I forgot. I run for more t-shirt, and we're prominently noted on the back of it and the front, so it was a fun event and definitely raised awareness for Project Pride. It, you know, we're all hoping to get the good word out before we're going to have some higher needs in the coming months.
Yeah.
And I just have to add that I had the opportunity to see Zip in action on Sunday, and you know, Zip is one of our own, and I can't reveal who it is, but they are amazing. They're an amazing.
So amazing.
Zip. Yeah, I mean, just connects with the kids and the adults, and it, I even saw Zip fight off a dog.
Yeah.
The squirrel wanted to go for the dog.
Very interesting interactions with the dogs.
Oh, really?
I've never
dogs
seen that.
Respond to Zip.
Would you get any video of that?
Oh, yeah. I'll send it to you guys and you can share it along. But
and I wasn't all that confident it was going to turn out well when I
agreed.
It goes south quickly. But,
and when you're the handler, you're like, I need to stand in between you and this.
Yeah. But Laura and Zip handled it very, very well. And,
Our Zip is.
And the dog were in better place.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
We have the legislative information updates in the packet. If you have any questions, we have Brenda White and Ryan Collins here to answer those.
I just would like a clarification on something about the auction summary report in the state overview.
Let me just state section.
Well,
maybe you can find it.
If you click on legislative overview.
Okay, it's in the
It's in the state.
Okay.
So about the auction summary report, where it refers to $2 million, almost $3 million, no cost allowances. Does that mean credits?
Yes, so Ryan Collins, Senior Program Manager for Government Relations at the district. Yes, so the no-cost allowances are a component of the Climate Commitment Act that are given to utilities and other industries. We are required under law to consign some of those every year, and those are the specific credits that you're referring to.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think that's all I had a question about, but
I have no
question.
Okay. No, I have none.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your report. Okay.
Thank you, Ryan. All right, next up is Angela Johnston, and she is going to provide some information on the most recent water bond issuance, some information that you need to provide. Morning, Angela.
Morning, thank you. Angela Johnston, Senior Manager at Financing Risk Management. So as a follow-up to the last board meeting where Scott Jones was able to communicate the pricing success of the water bonds, we wanted to just let you guys know that those bonds have a little bit more.
For the recording.
For the recording. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Well, back to hand. The bonds closed on the 12th of October, and those proceeds were deposited into the district's US bank account successfully, so that's great. We just have a few more administrative tasks to complete so that we can account for and monitor the use of those funds. So we will need to create four different funds in the district's portfolio in various reserves. And the first one would be the bond debt service reserve. Create one specific for these bonds. We need to make two funds in the sinking reserve so that we can facilitate principal and interest payments when they come due. And then the majority of those proceeds will be accounted for in the product reserve for a specific construction fund that we'll create for these bonds. That way we'll be able to monitor the use and make sure that all of that stays in compliance.
3 years.
You have to use it within a certain.
Yeah, it's ideal to use them in a 3 year period, but technically we have up to 5 before we make some major changes that would be impactful. So, but we'll be monitoring that and usually we're quite successful in a 3 year period. So, you know, no action for you guys today. We just want to inform you when these funds are added to the portfolio in compliance with our reserve resolution.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I do have a question.
Sure.
How did this sale go? I believe that we received just a short comments on possibly some challenges with this sale.
We did have to chase the market a little bit. We went in at a certain price and we needed to increase that on hold because the volatility in the market at the time when we were, it's uncertain how the, whether or not the government was going to shut down or not. So it increased people's anxiety and all of that has changed. But we were able to sell them all to our underwriter and they were successfully able to resell those in the secondary.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for your report.
Thank you.
Thank you, Angela. Before we move on to the next presentation, I want to take the opportunity quickly to introduce Ryan Kyle, who is our new senior manager for power scheduling. Ryan started in mid-August, comes to us from PSE, where he was a trader, also at the Energy Authority, has experience in real-time, day-ahead, and transmission, and super valuable, super excited that he's here, especially given all the things that are going on. And we have the water update, and then Peter's going to get into our energy risk management. So I thought it was an appropriate time to introduce Ryan to you.
It is. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Welcome. It's exciting to have you. You have such a background. Wow.
Yeah, well, John Medivore sold it, but I'm kidding.
Energy Authority, guarantee. Wow.
Yeah, so my name is Ryan Kyle, Senior Manager of Power Scheduling, taking over for Kelly Wallace. I'm really excited to be here. I've been here about 2 months, a little bit less as of now. And like John said, I did good experience going from TEA, Puget Sound Energy. I was there for the majority of my time in this industry, about 10 years. Most recently was in banking, doing analyst work, and excited to be back in the energy industry and excited to be at the PUD. It's been a great 7.5 weeks so far, and I'm really excited for the future.
Very exciting. Gotta get ready for that storm.
Yes. Lots of challenges that I forgot about, and a few new ones as well.
I see. I've got it.
Excited to be here.
Exciting work.
Yes. Yeah. Right? It is, indeed.
Thank you, meeting both.
Wish you well.
Looking forward to
the talk. And the organization.
Thank you.
All right, we have Mike Shapley with our water supply update. Morning, Mike.
Morning. Morning.
Morning, Commissioners. Mike Shapley. I am the PD short-term power trader, here to give you an update on the water supply, not only last year, but what we're looking ahead towards here as well. Last time we met was 6 months ago. So informational today, asking for anything other than just giving you a really good, really high overview and taking any questions you might have. So once again, we'll take a look at our PD energy portfolio mix, a look at the summary of how this past water year ended, which was September 30th of 23 this year, and then the forecast for 24.
Market purchases are nearing 10%. That's all I have to say.
Yes. All right, so why is water supply important to us? Well, you can see here, right? 84% of what we rely on comes from hydro generation and water supply. So these are pretty constant throughout most years, but this is a snapshot of 2022. All right, so in summary, our water year 23, October 1st, 2022, through the end of this past September, pretty bad, 76% of the 30-year average. We haven't seen that in some time. So it's become a pretty common theme. We started October of this year, as well as back in 2022, with drier soil conditions from, of course, a spring and summer that was very dry. Looked promising. We had a La Nina forecast that generally means you're going to have wet and cool conditions in the northern hemisphere. Well, it didn't quite turn out that way. We had a record winter cold, which was okay, great, but the precipitation just never really happened. And when it did, it was so cold that we really didn't get a rise in any of those run of river projects like we usually would. It was locked up in snow, but the precipitation that came was below average too. So ended 70th worst of the past 76 water years, South Border was. Quite atypical was that California, as you probably heard, benefited from a ton of precipitation, especially in the northern part of California. And I was talking to somebody who follows weather quite a bit too, and a lot of that develops, of course, out in the Pacific. And it just, think about it, just a minor change in that pattern. And it hit south versus, maybe 200-400 miles north, it would have been a different story. California got the rain, we did not. So, especially in the Upper Columbia, that's where it really hurt, because Upper Columbia is what really provides a lot of that long-term snow and runoff that we like in the spring and summer. So Jackson Hydro, if you take that project from its very beginning to this past year, we were 73% of average in terms of generation. Precipitation was at 71% of average. And then our Hancock and Calligan Creek performed below P50. We don't have much history there of those projects, so we're still working with data to come with some normals, but it was just cold and not wet. So when it did again turn cold, precipitation did come, it came as snow, but there wasn't enough of it. So it was really an odd, I'll show you some maps here shortly, but it was, October was one of those months where it was warmer than average. We had a little bit of precipitation. Boy, it was literally November 1st, it turned cold. And so anything that came down as precipitation came as snow and not as rain, as I mentioned. And Young's Creek as well, below P50 due to lack of precip and cooler conditions.
I do have a question, Mike. It says Jackson generation 73%. Wasn't Jackson down for a while? For something?
Yeah.
Wasn't it not generating for a period of time?
My years are running into each other, but yes, you're right. I think we did had some tunnel work that was being inspected for
so would that have affected this maybe?
Yeah, to a degree, but overall we ended up generating it later. We can only do so down to a certain level of spay the lake.
Right.
And so yeah.
Got
it. We used it later.
Yeah, we did the valve replacement. That in June?
Yes. Just wrapped up, not actually, that's when it began, correct? Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, and just some graphics of what I just spoke about. Not to get into the nitty gritty, but that chart on the left just shows you where the water year started in October. The green line is percent of average, so we already knew that it was looking to be a below average water year in terms of water supply. Some of those whisker plots went above the average mark, but not for very long. And so you can see that over time, as those whisker plots narrow, it's because you're getting towards the end of the water year and things are more certain. And so it just really never materialized. We had a little bit of positive in November, but after that, it was pretty much mostly downhill. And then just a graphic of seasonal precipitation for the entire water year on the right, just pointing out that the Northern Columbia, again, in Canada, suffered mostly below average seasonal precipitation, where we have longer term runoff that's beneficial for spring and summer. And you can see the southern portion of the basin, which again, California was really impacted, but you can see southeast portion of the basin did have some precipitation that was above average for the entire year. So here's the story of the temperature by month. As I mentioned in the top left, we had October that was warmer than average, and then literally, we had a flip on November 1st, and it pretty much was cold through the entire winter. The one break or near normal temperatures we had was in January, but you go all the way through the month of April, really into spring, and the whole water supply basin was for the most part below average temperatures in blue there. Then we had May, which brought really the runoff in a period of 2 weeks. It was that quick. And so much of the soil never had a chance to absorb any of that precipitation because of that October through November switch, where when the precip did come, it just couldn't get absorbed into the soil. And so a lot of it went into the ground in May. But some of it filled the reservoirs, which we always have to, like Grand Coulee. But what that meant was filling Grand Coulee just meant that we had to back off generation to do so because there was so little water. And then that warmer than average condition just pretty much continued through the entire water year with a little bit of break in temperatures in September. So this is just a pure water supply volume. It's what we use looking at the forecast by month, but this is actually showing you the actuals for the entire water year. The green triangle represents the 30-year average in terms of water flow. You can see every single month it was below, with the exception of May. So we have above average water supply volume in May, but most of that had to go to fill reservoirs. It didn't turn out to be generation for us. We ended up with roughly average generation for that month, even though the water supply volume was above average. And I think the next slide will show you that. Yes, so here is hydro comparison. We took 2012 through 2022, and we're looking at minimum, maximum, as well as average dispatchable federal resources. And you can see that the bars are this past water year 23. And you can see we had some new minimums in terms of dispatchable federal resources, April and October, two of them. June was right there as well. So just that month of May was the only one that was close to the average. Excuse me, November was there as well. But those 2 months were it. We had a benefit, I should say, in August, which, thank goodness, when we did see higher prices and higher temperatures, we were able to let's borrow from the Canadian projects, but we're paying it back right now. So low generation here for the first month of this water year too, but we will be full and we're praying for the rain. So what's in store for water year 24? So El Nino, a fairly moderate to strong El Nino. And so how are we starting this water year? Again, with drier than average soil conditions. That first map on the left is just portraying, you know, I don't want to get into the details too much, but more or less what it's saying in the northern part of the water supply basin, we have drought conditions, dry soil conditions. So again, a lot of the rain that's going to come, as long as it's not too cold, will be absorbed into the soil, which is great. That's got to happen either now or later, but we've got a deficit to make up there before we can fill reservoirs. So if you remember, El Nino typically brings warmer than average conditions to the northern hemisphere and usually drier as well. We're hoping it's going to be the flip of what we saw this past year, right? Because we saw dry conditions when it was supposed to be wet. But again, you know, we're right on the verge of that jet stream. Doesn't look promising right now in the 2 week forecast, but it's still early. So the seasonal forecast, those two maps on the bottom are just showing what's in store for these upcoming months of November, December, and January. Again, typically what we would see in El Nino type conditions, above average temperature probabilities with below average precipitation.
Last year was really memorable for my partner and me because we had planned this little tennis trip down to Palm Springs when it would be really bad here. Went down there and it was raining in Palm Springs.
Right. I took my son to Arizona in December, hoping for good weather. No, it was cold.
I know, and cold and wet.
Right. So we're hoping for the best. I wanted to bring up this map just to show you what happened this past winter. Of course, NOAA puts out a forecast at the beginning of the year. The top map is showing what the forecast was in terms of temperature. The top left, yeah, it was supposed to be cold in the northern hemisphere. The right map, yes, it was, but look at how far that cold extended down south. And on the bottom, they really missed the mark on the precipitation. Above average was the forecast was for this past winter. We talked about this already. Went all south, as you can see in the map on the bottom right, drier than average in the north and wetter than average in the south. So more to come in 6 months, but I'm sure you'll stay abreast of the news.
Well, it's kind of all that great.
Do you have any questions?
No, I don't. I interpreted this information correctly, and we have some challenges now.
Good news is it's early. So there's every water year is different. Once you think you've seen them all, you have a year like last year. Surprising.
I have no questions, but I do feel for the farmers. So let's see. I'm not 100.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. So from that and what we've been experiencing, past and what potentially may come in the future, appropriate to go right into our energy risk management report. Peter Downhauer and the team has done an extraordinary amount of work in reevaluating our energy risk management Peter will dive into that. Peter.
Hi, John. Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm Peter Downhauer, the Senior Manager of Rates Economics Energy Risk Management. Also want to acknowledge that Felicia Ng, in my department, contributed to this, as well as Angela Johnston. For this report, we have kind of two parts. We're going to look past the last 6 months and talk a bit about how our risk situation developed, and then transition to talking about some of the improvements we're making to the program to kind of respond to what we're seeing out there and ready ourselves for what we see in the future. So this presentation is just what I've said there, it's just information only. We had a series of recent meetings. This list keeps getting longer here, but we funded quarterly, and now we're doing it biannually. Back in 2021, we had a workshop support. So our agenda, as far as a little more detail, I'm going to look at some of our risk background and fundamentals, some sources of risks, and then do a retrospect over quarter two and quarter three of this year, and then talk about our risk strategy refresh and transition to the policy update, which is actually the next presentation. So a little bit of background on our sources of risk here. PD staff makes the best effort to anticipate the both the consumption of electric power by its customers, as well as the supply that we have available. And then we engage in transactions to meet our customer needs in a dependable, safe, responsible manner. These transactions include buying, selling, scheduling electric power, options for electric power and other energy commodities as necessary to meet our load and mitigate our risks. As far as our strategies are to keep our market position near neutral in the short term. Our short term horizon that we're talking about here is 30 months. Keep our exposure to market prices below the limits that we have. Limits are set to cap the impacts of market movements to no more than a 3% rate increase. And then define and update our uncertainties related to generation load and market prices. Have all that together, we transact market operations over time to try to average out some of the market variations. It's what we call the glide path. So as far as volume variability, these are some of the key components here. We've got load variability, slice variability, wind variability, and our forecasts are changing continuously throughout our time horizon. As we roll forward, we update our expectations accordingly. Just from the bars there, what you can see, we might expect that black line in the middle. You might be reasonably surprised by what might be in the orange bars there, orange area. But sometimes we do get these variations that go outside of those ranges, and those would be kind of the more unlikely, but still possible in the green and gray areas here. So with all that considered, we do have to continue to manage our risk here.
What's the orange area telling me?
Orange area.
Or orange, I guess.
Yeah, the orange area and the kind of yellow area with the wind variability is a little different, but the orange area would be the area between our P25 and P75 okay. forecast. So that would be our expectation, 50% chance we're going to get in between those ranges. 25% chance will be higher, 25% okay. chance will be lower, all things considered. And so with that variability, what we do is we set target positions, or also known as reserve margins, which is a deliberate amount of extra length that we carry into the month to ensure that we don't get caught surprised short in expensive markets. So we do this all these 30 months into the future. And what we do is we look at our historical volatility that we have, hydro, wind, load, and also we look at some months where we might have a concern about regional generation sufficiency. Now, I'll say a few things. This is our current process. We are proposing to change things around a little bit, exactly how these are calculated. So later part of the presentation, if you've read ahead, you may have noticed that.
I have some questions.
So, so our current methodology here is shown, where we would look at the variability, like we said, in between these months between load and wind, add that up, and then we also look at if perhaps a market situation might otherwise tell us to have a little bit more length going into these months. So as you can see from this table, there's some months which have higher load risk than other months. Unsurprisingly, throughout the winter, you can see that. Some months that have more wind risk, and then also some months where it's really the market that is defining this. It might be a little bit more of a top-up on our reserves than anything else. September, I think, is the unusual one here. We otherwise have few reserve limits, but our analysis would put us at 86. Anyways. So these would be our monthly targets that we plan towards. Just going to transition now to kind of looking at the past 6 months and how it went. Say it was a difficult couple of quarters. I think Mike Shapley has kind of set us up really well with some of the supply challenges we've had. Overall, we had about 87% of what we typically expect from our resources. And really across the board, that was felt. Particularly, you can look at Jackson, where we had some months were particularly low. Slice as well, a large part of our component. You can see in particular April and June, there's a big kind of missing component there. That's white area underneath the black bar. It's the difference between what we had planned and what we got. And the biggest component of that, of course, is our slice product. And you can see we're kind of missing out there. Slice in April was 70% of normal. June was 74%. Of course, we had a higher than usual May, but that didn't make up for the whole year here, or the whole half year. As far as demand, we had a slightly higher actual versus our budget. If you go month to month, a little bit higher than normal April. You can see it on this graph, but I did note it in a previous presentation here as coming out of January, February, March, where also water supplies were pretty low, and then being hit with a peak week for this period right at the start of April wasn't exactly helpful. But we did have our peak week there, as you can see, at the very start of April. Kind of unsurprising because we're coming from the cold winter to the warmer months, but April was our peak week low there. We're in 5 days in a row in the 30s. And then we had a heat wave in August worth mentioning as well, where August 15th was 92 degrees, pretty hot here. And that coincided with some markets, high market prices that I'll tell you about here in a second. So this is our market picture. So this would be our day ahead prices and real time prices. And I just noted as well our peak week, as well as that mid-August heat wave that I mentioned as well. And we had some pretty high prices throughout the periods. We had kind of high prices continuing from the winter time into April around that peak week. But in comparison to our mid-August heat wave, those were small deviations from the norm. And we could also kind of see how real-time prices through July had some quite a bit of volatility. You see that little up-down with the red curve there throughout July that was happening. But it all really fails in comparison to what we saw in August, where we saw real-time prices $1,300, day-ahead prices, the market cap at 976 during that heat wave. So a little bit, I'll come back to kind of the August situation, but as far as our peak week demand and how we did there, we were a net buyer. So our peak week here, the way we do it is we look at the every week and look at average load compared to over that period, and this was the period that had the highest loads. So the gray bar, I should say the gray area there, told us our kind of daily average load versus our monthly planned load. So I think the biggest difference would probably be on the third there, where our planned load was at 767 and our actual was 923. And our actual highest peak period, I should say peak hour, was at hour 7 to 8 a.m. on the 5th. Nearly 1,100 megawatts. Prices were not too bad, all things considering. Kind of in between the $80 and $100 range. So as far as peak weeks that we've seen in the past and in these presentations, it's not as severe as what we might have seen in the winter peak, right? Which is good. Okay, gonna go on to our actual risk test that we do. Any questions before we get into that? So one risk test that we look at is our credit limit analysis and our current exposure. So we have 35 approved trading counterparties. You'll notice that we added one, and we made a credit limit adjustment to another. We didn't have any exceedances on these tests, but what this test does is it looks at the cost of all the active transactions with that specific counterparty. And we look at the current market prices with those counterparties, and we compare that to the limit that is set based off of their credit reports that they have. Some counterparties will have higher credit, others will have less, and we keep it under those bounds to keep ourselves safe. So you can kind of see a range of where we landed here. It's really the black diamond is the average throughout the periods with that counterparty. And you can see the minimums as well, which is also kind of interesting. So that would have been a single point in time. So we do this test every time we run the model, which is pretty much daily. So we have a lot of tests there. I didn't want to make this too busy, but in any case, that was the our credit test that we did. We also have the financial load resource imbalance test. And so this one is looking at our net power position, assuming what we usually plan at, which was our slice at P25, wind and load at P50 are expected positions there. And we call that our open position. And we look at what the price on the market would be if we took those open positions and applied the relative respective prices. And then we set limits where no open position is allowed to have a market value over the value shown there for a month, quarter, year. And each one of these dots, just looking at this graph, would represent a test. So we have many months in this test. Every day we're going to have a test. So you can see that there's quite a lot of those monthly tests. We only have one book position, so we still have a lot of tests there. What we can see from this is that we did have multiple exceedances throughout the period, particularly in the book and calendar position, as well as in the quarter. There was a number as well, quite a bit fewer in the monthly test. And this is due to high market prices that we had. So if we take that long position we have, apply those prices, it's going to come up as more value, and they were coming up over our limit set. It's a combination of that and our need to retain our long position. So the risk committee erring on the side of having more length. Also look at our price test. So this test is a little bit different. Really what it's looking at is take those open positions that we have. So we have some length there, and we look at the prices that we see in the market, the volatility in the market, take a given month, and then we say, okay, given that volatility, if it's high volatility, let's assume prices go the wrong way, in this case, down if we have a long position. And it's a pretty strong assumption here, a two standard deviation price change. So we only expect that in sort of extreme scenarios, you might say. And we do that over a day and over a week. And if that amount that we would have lost there is higher than our limits, then we look at that and act on it. And so we can see here again all the different tests that were taken, fewer exceedances here than in the open market position test, but in a similar spot, both calendar and book, we had multiple exceedances throughout the quarter, or throughout the last 6 months. And it's for a similar reason. We do see high market prices, we see high volatility, we've been seeing that, although some volatility that we've seen coming down a little bit. But also a need to retain our long position. So despite these tests coming back saying there's an exception here, all of a sudden we should sell, we're voting to maintain these long positions. So in summary about our limit exceedances, we've had, again, high market prices, volatility. This is a situation we've seen over the last year or longer. We have overall long portfolio positions, making sure that we have enough length to carry the variation, the volatility variation that we see in our resources and loads. And so that is reason why we've had those exceedances. We've responded by transacting on the market to reduce the physical length wherever possible. That's been limited to some degree because we've been looking where we want to be, comparing that to where the risk model would tell us to go, and erring on the side of having more length, as I said. And really, this past year, particular starting this period of review here, we've implemented a risk strategy refresh, and we're proposing a risk policy statement update, which is in the next presentation. So we've taken a hard look at what we do and see how we can do this better, make sure there's some better alignment. So I think we have one more slide about kind of looking forward, and then we transition to kind of some of the improvements that we're making. Firstly, looking at Q4 of 2023 and Q1 of 24, what we can look at the prices and volatilities that we've seen over the last few months here. Actually, this extends all the way back to November of 22. So we do see some pretty high prices and a bit more volatility going through last winter. We've seen prices settle down quite a bit with the Q4 prices in the $100 range, as well as the Q1 prices in the $100 range. Volatility is coming down a little bit. So that's good to see that we're having a little bit more stability on the volatility side. Some of this is also just new information coming into the market, transaction here and there, moving the market a little bit. So we do expect that, particularly further out, that we might see a little bit of a jump here and there. So all things told, I'm looking at those forward prices and saying, hey, I like to see the volatility a little bit lower than typical right now, going into those months. Okay, I'm going to move over to the recent risk program improvements. So like I said, staff has really jumped into how we can improve this and make sure we've got some better alignment with our motivations here. Any questions before I move on to that? Just realizing it's a bunch of slides here.
I wish I understood how it works with forward markets. Who determines that? How is that? You have resources.
Sure. So we look
how far forward are you?
We look 30 months forward, so it's always
it's
a rolling period. So as we go forward in time, our 30 months, and it has varied between 30 and 18 months technically, but we're always kind of refreshing our look at when we get closer to calendar 25, we start looking at that and so forth. And so we We try to transact bilaterally. We have our counterparties out there. We also get information from markets on the prices that are out there. And so when we get these prices that come back, it's a record of a transaction that occurred, not necessarily between ourselves and a counterparty, but it sets a price. And so that's what really what that market does, is it helps us know what those prices are and how people are valuing those prices. And so it's really critical information what those prices are and how our counterparties are. You know, it tells you a little bit what their underlying positions are. Counterparties are willing to buy more or sell higher, then there's a reason for it. The closer we get to that period in the forward horizon, the more information we really know about it. So we're transacting a year out, further out. It's really based off of planning models. People are planning one way or another. As we get closer, as we know ourselves, we get an updated forecast on how our slice is, we get more information about our loads, and we start to have more certainty about what our position is actually going to be. And so that is when we really know the value of that too. Same with the counterparties. You think about how these markets come together and what value they offer. It's a pretty incredible process. Our scheduling team goes through it every day. So,
Mr. Olson, do you have questions? At this point,
not at this point.
The other question in my mind, and when you do all these tests and you do many, many, many every day, are those computerized software programs that allow you, so you guys put all the info in, data in, and then you get the tests?
Yeah, we've built it in-house, exactly what you say there is that we have all our current position, all our forecasts included in there, as well as the market information, which is namely the prices and the past prices that we've seen. And it's fully automated. We make some, we can do it on an ad hoc basis. After the commission session, we could run it if we want, but we do it on a pretty much daily basis.
Thank you.
Sometimes more than daily.
Yep. So now we're going to go into improvements.
Yes.
Just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
In kind of planning the forward, the test for planning forward needs or forward prices.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think I understood was, at the beginning of that, you really, that's where you have your greatest challenges. In terms of when you get to the end of that, I don't know if it's 30 months or whatever the term is,
mm-hmm.
Of course you know more, and you get closer. So is that window of where you're so far out, and there's so many variables, and then you find out sometime down the line
mm-hmm.
that your projections weren't right or weren't as positive as you would like them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're trying to resolve?
I think what you're saying here is that we do have some what I would say volumetric uncertainty. So we remember those bars,
yeah.
Slice and hydro.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't necessarily know 30 months in advance whether or not we're going to get a good one or a bad one, right? And so it is always a trade-off. It's a trade-off between saying, do we want to have certainty of the amount of lake that we have,
yeah.
Versus certainty of the prices. We want to have certainty of the prices. Act in one way or another, but then we leave ourselves up to the sort of volume uncertainty too. So what we try to do is ensure that we are within our requirements of volume. And the developments as far as the resource adequacy discussions have really helped us define that, as well as some of the work out of the IRP to kind of say, here's what we think our peak week needs are. This has helped define this more clearly than we have in the past. On the sort of price certainty side, it's always going to be a trade-off. And that's what we're hoping a little bit with these improvements that we're.
Yes, I didn't state it correctly, but that's what I.
Did I answer your question, or did I just kind of go around it?
I didn't ask it right. That's where I was leading to in terms of trying to link new opportunities to improve. Okay, I'm done.
Okay. And maybe in first thing, and Peter can certainly say this much better than I, but if you think back to the challenges that we've had last December and in the first quarter that Mike had demonstrated from the water and ultimately the hydro perspective. So we had planned, if you go 30 months back, and then as we got closer, we had planned for a certain amount of generation. Well, we got far under that amount of generation. So we had to go into the market. We had also planned that the market prices would be at a specific place. Well, with less generation available, market prices go up, and that's where those two converged, where we were exposed. And a lot of what Peter is talking about, and we'll get into more in depth in the improvements, is holding more length means we're gonna hold on to more power, more energy, so that we can weather those types of situations better. Now it costs us, from an opportunity perspective, we could sell that, and that's where the exceedances are, right? Our model says, hey, we should sell that. And we're saying, no, we're not gonna sell it because of what we've experienced and what we believe is gonna be the case going forward, based on all the resource adequacy needs and the energy and capacity needs going forward. And the generation supply. That makes sense?
It does. I think I need to get into the next section.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll hold that thought. We'll pin that question.
Helped me a lot. I tried to put all this together when I was studying it. Thank you.
So a little recap here is, we also get some information from our IRP, and like I said, the resource adequacy discussions are at RAP. And both of these sources are telling us to hold more reserves. We also can, than what we're currently holding in our risk program. So that methodology that I spoke about, if you compare that to what the IRP and RAP are saying, it's saying, well, actually, you should be holding more. We want to make sure that we have alignment there between those programs and what we're doing in the short term so that we set ourselves up for this 30-month period. We're not setting ourselves up and then going and undoing all that work that we might have set up in the IRP and so forth. So that needs to have better alignment. And the end result of that is let's hold more reserves. That's the overall direction. We also are aware that the risks that occur within a month, for example, through our day-ahead market purchases, are not sufficiently observed in our tests, and this reduced the accuracy of our measurements. So, we're holding length because we know we're probably going to need it, but our tests aren't sort of reflecting that. We need to make sure that they reflect that. So that's an improvement. And then we are looking at financial hedging versus physical hedging, which just allows us to hold on to that physical position, but manage some of those market risks, those sort of price risk. And I think when we look at the slide here, I can show you, really what we're trying to scoop up and address with that new tool. So, like I said, we've sort of practically responded. In practice, this is what we've been doing. We've been erring on the side of holding more length. We want to make that a part of the program formally. The risk refresh has also taken a significant step to revise our policies and processes to kind of consider the future market conditions and prepare ourselves. So here we've experienced something. We've had this last winter. We've had this situation. We're looking forward at RAP and IRP telling us to hold on to more length. We're expecting variability. We're expecting things like full plants going out of service. So let's prepare our risk program for that future as well. And then this whole effort is an effort in continuous improvement. So it's worth mentioning that this is what we do all the time. We're always improving our risk model, our risk program. This is part of that we're happy to share with you. Okay, first one. So this says, so what are we actually doing here? So firstly, let's hold on to more length. So we've established new volumetric capacity reserve requirements. That's what the graph is showing you here. This is saying, let's hold on more. So this would be the not the final, necessarily the final numbers, but a sort of description of the direction that it would be going. You can see the old positions would be in the kind of light yellow, almost beige color there. And the new reserves would be in a darker or brighter yellow. And you can see pretty much across the board, it's a bit higher, significantly higher. And that's what the blue bars are telling you, is that particularly, and this is shown on a water year schedule starting with October, particularly through the winter, you see those blue bars growing up to extra 57, 75 megawatts. And then even in the summertime, July and August, it's seeing higher reserves. The only month which is really doesn't fit that is September, where I mentioned before, due to our study that looked at the concerns with the market being short during that period of time, we had bumped up those September reserves previously. So this is more aligned with the integrated resource plan. In fact, what we used is a result from the integrated resource plan to kind of modify our framework to go from what we expect in an average month versus what we might need in a peak week. So those are different metrics, right? Average month versus a peak week. And what we might need in a peak week, it's going to be higher in that given month. So that's what that's telling us. What's that look like? Now, we expect that there's an interaction here with what we see with the resource adequacy and RAP as well. So we also are intending to, let these sort of layer in. And when RAP comes, it's going to have higher requirements, capacity requirements. So let's get ourselves prepared for that by using our IRP to the best that we can. This is the bridge that I'm talking about here with creating a bridge to resource adequacy. Okay, so we're going to hold more length. Second, let's improve our risk metric accuracy. So existing reserves, we set ourselves up to cover the needed length over a whole month, but we know that peaks within a month sometimes require us to buy on the market at high prices, and these can be significant. So we want to account for this when we do our tests so that we're more accurate. So here's our peak week in April, and I wrote down a few extra notes here. Is this peak week we had just under 900K in day and real-time purchases, and we had 24K, this is dollars, in sales, and so it cost us something like 850,000. And that was for 1,100 megawatt hours that we ended up buying. So that was, that's a peak week in April, right? That's what we have to what we deal with on a risk basis here. The August heat wave, we had about $1 million in purchases and 850 in sales. I should say 650 in sales or so. So that cost us 400K. And it's worth mentioning that our team did really well with kind of making use of our hydro that we had available with both Slice and with Jackson to sort of minimize those costs. Remember, $1,000 a megawatt hours. I looked it up. We were using Jackson to our full extent. We also had a little help from our wind. And we actually also went out to our customers. You may or may not remember. We asked them voluntarily, hey, you can help us out by reducing your usage and conserve. So that kind of gives you two examples of these types of peak week situations that we want to better measure when we do our tests. I had to mention that second one just because power supply did an awesome job on that one. Okay, thirdly, let's look at adding financial trades to our tool belt. So I think Angela is going to speak next about a little bit of history of our financial hedging and our tools here, but what I'm trying to point out here is how we can use that to really address one of the challenges, ongoing challenges we've had. So we've had this time and again. You can see by this test, this is the same set of tests that we did before. We're seeing as the model saying, go out and sell this length that you have. particularly further out in our position, where we don't have too much information about it. And we're saying, I think we'll hold on to that because we know we need it, because we've just experienced the winter we experienced. We know that RAP and IRP are saying, hey, we have peak week needs that are beyond what we might need in a typical month. So our practice has been to hold on to that out of being conservative. And so financial trades will really allow us to target these exceedances. Get a little bit more liquidity in terms of trading partners further out there. We expect to at some point. And there's more options for basically looking at that, those periods where we have these exceedances, and locking in some of our future prices. So by doing that, we'll reduce our exceedances here, but we'll be able to hold on to our physical position. And this is important because RAP, for example, is saying you have to have this sort of physical capacity position. And so we need to maintain that ability as well. So it's really an important toolkit that we can use to kind of address some of these challenges and sort of set us up better with a little more certainty as far as our revenues and manage some of these risks further out. So as a result of these sort of improvements, we've also looked at our ERMC policy statement and suggested some changes. I won't get into the details of that quite yet because it's the next presentation, but really it's pointing to some really, I think, common sense changes to the policy that will help us respond to see on the markets, what we expect in the future, and the improvements that we're trying to make to actually manage some of those risks. So that's my transition to the next presentation.
Well, don't go too fast.
Okay.
I'm not grasping you're adding financial trades.
Yeah.
And then there's the commodity, which we have traditionally done, buying and selling power. So help me understand how those interact. Maybe with an example. I'm really not understanding the financial hedging.
Sure. And I can say that if it's of use, we can also kind of do a refresh on the workshop idea.
Oh, we had a workshop. Okay.
Just as we're getting closer, so it's not no problem. Happy
I can look it up too and read it.
But the idea is that there's a financial value of that length, and if
yeah,
we were to
yeah.
market right now, we'll say 12 months in advance, we expect to have a certain amount of length.
Okay.
And we can look at the forward prices, and we can say there's a certain amount of value. Now that value, not being traded, sits on our book, right?
Okay.
As something that might change in the future. We're risk averse. We don't want, we want to know what our prices are. We want to be able to set our budgets. We want to be able to plan around those types of things. So what the financial trade would do is to say, okay, well, between us and the counterparty, we can set what that price is right now. When it comes time to actually deliver, so fast forward 12 months in advance, we would have that length, right, still. And we would then be doing what we typically do is if we have that length, we'd be selling it on the day ahead markets. And we'd be accumulating some revenues as a result of that.
Okay.
And that counterparty would also be looking at a day ahead market, and they'd be buying because that's what they need, right? And so we would both be having, a set of revenues or costs coming in. And at the end of the day, we would come back and say, okay, well, we agreed to this price. One payment has to go to one counterparty or the other. It gives us the price certainty because of that. There's going to be situations where the actual prices that we pay are going to be higher than the contract or lower. But the price certainty is what we're going there for.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think you said that the RAP requires us to hold on to the exceedances. Did I hear that?
The RAP would require us to hold on to capacity in certain months, and that complying with that, holding on to that capacity would likely produce would likely give us more exceedances, similar to what we've kind of been seeing, or perhaps even more. If we increase our reserve targets, and we do all those tests, the value is going to be higher, and we're going to have more exceedances as well. That's kind of a preview of what we expect. It's something that the risk committee has to be just, you know, clear-eyed about. This is a transition. We think we're doing the right thing by erring on the side of having more length when we need it. And we can start building up this particular tool to kind of help manage that a bit better. Yeah.
Okay. Just to make sure we're in sync, part of the improvement is to adjust the reserve requirements, right? The volumetric capacity reserve requirements, so we're not exceeding as we are currently as often.
If we increase the volumetric, so I think so. We're not running into the kind of day ahead and real time market risk. So the within month risk that we've seen in the past, exactly.
Thank you. I'm risk averse.
I think I can speak for everyone. We are. Yeah. We have to. Yep.
Is this typical of? Are we coming into the 21st century here?
We are entering the 21st century here.
Okay.
I think other utilities in the area, and I'll ask Angela to help me out if I say something wrong here, but other utilities in the area, including Publix, have used financial trading more extensively, perhaps through an entity that does it for them. So we've had it in our books that we can do it, but we haven't really taken steps to actually make it possible. Think about everything that goes into it. But yeah, this is a 21st century step here.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Okay, thanks very much.
Madam President, can I recommend that we take a brief recess?
Yes, let's come back at 10:20. Then we'll recess until 10:20. Okay, we are back. It is 10:20. And we are going to proceed with Angela now. Angela Johnston.
Yes, Angela Johnston, Senior Manager, Treasury and Risk Management. Thank you. So as a compliment to Peter's presentation and risk update, we wanted to separate this presentation specifically to explain what we're doing with the energy risk management policy, and the fact that we want to do an update to it to be able to facilitate the hedging program. There we go. Thank you. So the purpose of this presentation, again, is to inform the board of those changes that we would like to make to the policy statement, and also to let you guys know all of the efforts that the staff has been making. Peter's alluded to it, and I'll expand and give because it has been a long time coming. There's no actions for you guys today, but we will be back on the 7th to present that resolution and to amend the policy statement as we're going to describe today.
Will we get that when the board book is published just a few days ahead of the meeting?
Correct. Okay. That's the intention, yes.
Did the board originally establish this policy?
They did, yes. So on my background slide here, we can go into that a little bit. We've got a energy risk management policy that you guys last saw and approved in 2008.
Yeah, and it was tied to a specific thing. Losing a lot of money.
Maybe.
Well, it was. I'm not going to go into detail, but okay. And it was a big, the board had a big brouhaha over it, so I didn't recall that we had approved it.
As far as my research goes, and maybe Colin or anyone else can jump in, the 2008 was the last time that you saw that, this policy statement.
Yeah.
In combination with adding our ability to financially hedge our financial trade.
Okay.
So,
Not really a question, I'm a little surprised.
Yeah, no, that's actually.
This is just an operational.
Right, this is actually one of the things I wanted to talk about. It's been a really long time since we've updated this policy. We've done some changes to the manual itself over time, but this policy itself hasn't been updated since then. So all of Peter's discussion earlier really tells you why we're doing this exercise, right? We've changed our risk profile, or actually, we didn't change it. It got changed for us. The regulatory environment, the market, it's caused our risk profile to change, and we need to change along with it. We have the ability to financially trade, but we don't have the program in place. And so that's a lot about what this presentation is about, is how are we getting that financial trading in place so that we can add it to our tool bucket of risk mitigation. So first off, it feels like the top of the cake in terms of what we've done, but specifically we wanted to let you guys know what the staff is recommending for the policy statement update. We would like to add to the statement to explicitly say that a QIR, a qualified independent reviewer, is necessary to review those financial trades along with the risk manager and our middle office function. So
we now don't have that.
We do not have that right now. It's part of what is required of us to be able to do a financial trading program in compliance with Dodd-Frank protocols. So we need to do that. As the type of entity that we are, we're allowed to have an inside or engage for an external. Based on our staff capacity, we've decided to go external, and that'll come in the future.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, what agencies are connected to that?
What agencies provide those services? It's pretty interesting, actually. We did a very, very long, in-depth research on trying to find a qualified independent reviewer. We had about maybe 5 interviews with different agencies, and we found a couple that provides our very specific, what we are requiring with the type of product that we are going to financially hedge. So we have discussed with TEA to provide those services, and we're currently in contract drafting and negotiating to get those services, hopefully by the end of the year. So you'll see it again.
So we will be, we will be approving the hiring of this QIR.
No, it'll go through our procurement process as any other contract would. It's a low enough value that you probably won't see that.
Thank you.
Another item that we wanted to add to the statement itself was identifying the full finance division. With financial program, there's a lot more compliance. There's a lot more engagement of different functions throughout finance. So we just made that administrative change. As Peter discussed, we would like to increase our length of managed exposure to 36 months. Correct me if I say anything wrong, Peter, but essentially this is administrative. It's easier to manage a 3-year rather than a 2.5. It also allows us to have a longer period of time to increase our ability to manage liquidity and find counterparties from which to do transactions. All right. And then we had some other minor grammatical changes.
Thank you.
Yes, of course.
Always like that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So what I really consider the meat of everything we did is this next slide. We took the risk manual that's underneath that policy statement, and we reviewed it in combination with the strategy update, our new risk profile, everything else, new eyes, new teams. We took a really in-depth look. And I'd say the top 3 things that were updated in the manual, not only related to financial hedging, but was to include those risks that we are seeing now, update those based on what's new from the last time this went through the process. And I want to say that was maybe like 2012, but it's the last time I remember it being so highly revamped. Then we also added financial hedging processes and procedures. We added an entirely new section, and I'll say that Lauren Way was the impetus of that and worked really hard to make that happen. And we also updated the roles and responsibilities of the risk committee, very administrative, but needed to be put down to be in line with the current practices. So you'll see all of those shapes there. So many people were involved with this, finance, rates, power scheduling, power supply, legal, and we also had external consultants help us with reviewing the statement in general, and then also to be able to look at our credit policy and procedures again. Okay. So just a little bit more background on the financial hedging program and what it's been taking to get it going. Again, hoping by the end of the year, crossing my fingers, but we do have some things that are outside of our control, and so we do our best to get things going. One of those items, as I mentioned earlier, is the QIR engagement, and that will just come when it comes as far as negotiations. Other items that I wanted to point out on this slide is our compliance with new standards, Dodd-Frank protocols. It's not something that we've necessarily had to know, learn, implement, and so we're doing some education and then also fitting that into our policies and procedures. I think, any questions on any of this?
Into it. International swaps, what is that?
Oh, swaps under ISDA agreement. So to be able to financially hedge, one way to do that is to have a bilateral agreement with different counterparties, and that is an ISDA agreement. Okay. It's a very standard, well, I'm going to quote, standard document of which you can go in and start negotiations with a counterparty, and we have that going on right now with a counterparty.
Okay.
It's nearly finished, but all of these other things had to come in before it, before we can finalize it. Most specifically, the engagement of the QIR in compliance with Dodd-Frank protocols.
So when you mentioned the counterparty, you're talking about the same counterparties that we've been told about before, or different counterparties?
It can be different. It could be different, right? We have a list of, I think, the slides at 36 counterparties active, maybe less than that. And you will try to engage financially and maybe make a bilateral agreement with those counterparties as well. But it could be different. It might not be the same list, but we'll certainly want to choose from that list. We have a relationship with them, and it would be beneficial to do that. But it could be different.
Is this related to the commodities market?
So in terms of
puts and calls and all that?
I'm not.
Probably not if you don't know.
Yeah, well, that's not necessarily true. I can look into that and get back to you.
Oh, it's just, I'm trying to sort it all out.
Sure, yeah.
Do these counterparties then, are they subject to the same review as our trading counterparties?
So is your question?
Over time, I mean, some will stop. Some we're very comfortable with, others we're not, so they're very little.
Oh, you mean their credit, their allowable credit?
Yeah.
Yes, and so when we engage with a counterparty in this way, with a bilateral agreement, a very large section of that is a credit allowance. And so with a counterparty, we will say, here's your financial health, here's all the things
okay.
that we know about you, and we'll assign a credit for that.
Okay.
Yes, most definitely. Any other questions?
Oh.
Financial Training 101. I should have read this first.
Yeah, well, and actually, you know, Peter did a really good job of summarizing the next few slides. He did a great job. There are maybe just a couple highlights that will say, alluding a little bit to the counterparty, we've got some advantages of doing financial trading. The additional liquidity. We actually do have a counterparty right now that we would like to engage with, but they do not want to do physical trading. They only want to do financial. And so it will open up our counterparty list, and that's a good advantage of this program. But the creation of those bilateral agreements are time consuming. And so it is a consideration. It's risk, or it's a consumption of our staff capacity that we need to consider. But we'll be moving forward and trying to expand our counterparty list that we can do financial trading with, so that we don't have to necessarily be a price taker. We want a wealth of options. Yes. Right. And so we'll be looking at those bilateral agreements, increasing those, but also looking towards potential exchanges to become a part of as well. And Peter also did a very good job of explaining this example. Really what I wanted to have you come away with this slide is the price certainty. The risk is still there. We will have gains and losses, but we will know that much further ahead of time, and we'll be able to plan for those. Okay. So the next step is I will come back next board meeting with a resolution to amend that policy statement to have those items that we discussed. Let's see you then. Any questions?
I appreciate this.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to this kind of detail for me. I'm going to go back to our workshop briefing.
Yeah, I kind of want a homework assignment, you know, so I can
Yeah, it's very complex. There's lots of weeks to get into, and to the extent that you need us to help you get into them, let us know.
Well, I think for me right now, it's a little superficial. My knowledge is a little superficial, but I'm trying, and I appreciate all the effort in trying to educate us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, we're not getting into the where you have a floor of, what do they call it, trading floor? We're not getting into that, are we?
No.
We have a trading floor.
Well, we kind of do, but it's the primary driver is not profit.
No, it's to meet our load.
Just because when I saw some of this, it brought me back to 2008. When there was an interpretation that was entirely different. Thank you.
No. Our primary objective is to meet our customers.
Thank you.
All right, that's it. Great job, Angela and Peter. That concludes the presentations.
I just overlooked one thing in the legislative report. I mean, it wasn't in the, it was at the end with the articles to read. And I'm not going to ask questions too much now, but I'll, at some point, probably during commission business or sometime before the end of the day, I want to find out what the PUD is doing to protect the waters from Copper Lake, where the helicopter landed in Copper Lake. I'm sure you know about that. And I'm trusting that things are being done. Check that water supply. They're supposed to get the helicopter out.
Yeah, we can have an update this afternoon.
Could I maybe ask you about that in the commission reports?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Oh, so there being no further business for the morning session, we will recess into executive session to discuss.
Go ahead. Sorry.
What?
No, you're fine.
What else? No, what did I miss?
You did. It's me. Go ahead.
I'm glad it's you and not me. Okay, I'll repeat. It is now 10:37 a.m.
The board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated that the executive session will last approximately 45 minutes and conclude at, what would that be? Let's see, 48. What time would that be? Help me out here.
11:20.
45 minutes would be. Oh, it would be 11:20 when we expect to conclude our executive session.